and this is Bear Radio with your host, the Optimistic Bear. This is the show where armchair economists rule the roost. We don't claim to be experts on finance or economics, but we sure enjoy talking about it. Anything we can tangentially claim to be related to finance or economics is fair game. And you are listening to Bear Radio with the Optimistic Bear. This is the show where armchair economists rule the roost. We don't claim to be experts on the economy or anything else, but we sure have fun talking about it. And anything that we can tangentially claim is related to economics is fair game. And tonight we have one of our regular commentators on the show, Elliot. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. How's it going?
Really good. We haven't done a show in a few weeks here, but we just had to get together and talk because of what's been happening recently. What, I mean, the silver market is down 25% in a week?
Yeah, that was one heck of a move. And you know, today was a nice down move too. I wasn't really surprised. I mean, when silver had been going parabolic for so long, and this is a completely normal behavior for the metals. I mean, they've done this many times throughout history. They do kind of this blow off move, which in many ways resembles a stock market bottom, because they're driven by the same sentiment, which is usually fear, you know, fear of dollar inflation, I think, is one of the big things here. But of course, there's a lot of people that were long silver, and there's just too many people piled up on one side of the trade. So I think they kind of all panicked out, you know, at the same time. Again, well, completely normal.
Well, it's not just silver. I mean, it's almost across the board. You see commodities dropping left and right: gold, copper, platinum. You see the dollar shooting up, which is
right.
And so it's not just the silver. And what's fascinating is I was reading a bunch of articles, and people were blaming all of the other problems in the commodity markets and the dollar on silver. They were saying, oh, it's the problems with silver that are causing the dollar to appreciate.
Right, the problems with silver. That's interesting. Well, the thing about the dollar, you know, it went down a lot more than I thought it was going to. But the big key in my mind is that it did not break the 2007 low, which it set before the 2008. I think if it had broken that low, then I would probably say, all right, we probably are not going to have any more deflation. You know, watch out for more inflation, and we'd be in a different scenario. But it didn't break the low, and in fact, if you look at the larger pattern, it looks very similar to sort of the smaller pattern it traced out in early 2007, where it had a nice move up and then almost went back down to touch that low. So it's not an abnormal, in terms of technical analysis at least, it's really not that abnormal to see the dollar do what it did and still have the potential for, you know, to make new highs above the 2008 highs. You know, it just took a lot of time getting there.
Well, the big question, of course, is this just a flash in the pan, or is this indicative of something, of a major trend change happening in the markets, right? Like, we had a flash crash a year ago, or over a year ago now, and, you know, that panicked everybody with things dropping in value in very short order. But then, you know, markets got back up on their feet, and it didn't take all that long for things to recover.
Right. Well, you know, obviously no one can say for certain about the answer to that. I don't know. I guess personally I feel like this is going to be a larger move down than the previous small corrections we had, just because things are just so overdone here. But, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see. And I really, we've talked about this before. I'm not a big fan of gambling or speculation, and I think the average person, an average investor, shouldn't really be, you know, trying to anticipate the future and speculating too much based on that. You know, I think it's usually better just to stay in cash and you know, focus on business. And if you want to be in the markets, then you have to learn a trading method, which is kind of a separate thing. But kind of doing the in-between thing where you, you know, kind of speculate, but you don't really dedicate to a trading system or methodology is kind of this middle ground that can be a little dangerous. So I don't know. That's why I always shy away when people want me to say what's going to happen, because if you get blamed if you're wrong, you know.
Oh, sure.
Never
but
good.
I agree with much of what you're saying, but I to a certain extent, I think that people – you can't be – you have to take risk. There is no such thing as just saying I'm just going to focus on business and not do anything else, because when it comes to – I agree completely about trying to speculate on short-term market moves, right?
Right.
I totally agree that that's completely unpredictable.
I won't even quite say that. I mean, you can – there are people out there that make tons of money doing exactly that.
Okay, but it's
the
very
point is that they dedicate – it's a full-time job, and they become very good at it. Whereas, you know, I'm talking about people where it's not a full-time job.
Okay, but even
it's just going to be impossible.
But even for amateurs, people for whom investing is not a full-time job,
right?
Everyone does make, whether they realize it or not, they are making serious investment decisions that have big repercussions and contain a lot of risk. Because, for example, you have to take a stand. Do you believe that we are going to be headed for a greatly inflationary environment or a deflationary environment?
Right.
You can't invest for both. You cannot do it. You have to pick one or the other. And so at some level, you have to have some worldview of where you think things might be headed in the next 10 or 20 years.
Well, you know, you really are right about that. I mean, even here's something I'm doing in my own life, because I still believe more deflation is going to eventually come down the pipe, is in the housing market, which is why I'm still renting, even though I've been told repeatedly about buy a house. You know, but, you know, the property markets are still down. They haven't stopped crashing despite the rally in other assets. They're just still going, you know, pretty steadily to new lows. So I think I made the right decision here, but it was a speculation, you know, and I know a lot of people who bought a house thinking that was the right decision. So I guess you're right. You know, that's one of those major things. Everyone's got to have a roof over their head. So do you want the inflationary roof or a deflationary roof, you know, which would basically be owning or renting?
I think it's actually worse for somebody. I think it's important for everyone to acknowledge that what they do with their money is inherently risky, right? Even if you take your money and put it in a bank, there is risk involved in that. Well, the bank could go under. There could be a big banking collapse, and the government can't even fund the money. But even more than that, putting your money in the bank is saying that you don't think inflation is going to be very high. Because if you were concerned about inflation being high, then you would be putting your money into a great inflation hedge or precious metals or something
else.
So no matter what you do, there will be risk in it. And I think just being aware of that is likely a very good thing.
Right. That's absolutely true. So let me backpedal again, because I went through this whole spiel about how the average person shouldn't speculate. But then at the same time, we're saying, well, you can't avoid it. It's impossible because, you know, even the necessities of life involve investment speculation. Isn't that a great situation to be in? But I don't know if it was always that way. I mean, there are probably many periods of time where housing was not, you know, so out of whack, so overvalued that I guess you could make a saner decision. But Maybe what I should say is, you know, there are different levels of risk, and I think the average person doesn't need to take as much risk as people advocate. You're right, you can't get around speculating, but I think you can still reduce your risk. Like, if you do decide to buy a house, don't buy $1 million home or something on credit. Buy something that's, you know, a little more within your means, you know, whatever that may be. And I think that's a reasonable advice in terms of reducing your risk.
I mean, risk is a very, very fascinating subject, which I can talk at for great lengths of time. And I mean, just the thing about risk too is that a lot of ways people approach risk, humans, myself included, we have very strange ways of assessing risk, which aren't necessarily very accurate, right?
Right.
And just one example that comes to mind when it comes to investing is you'll hear people talk about diversification, and they'll feel that they're safe because they purchased a whole bunch of different asset classes, and they'll say, hey, I'm safe because if any one of these asset classes go bad, I'll be okay with the others. But it turns out that a lot of asset classes are correlated with one another. I mean, just look how we were just talking about how commodities are all crashing and the dollar is going up. Well, if someone had diversified and said, oh, I bought lots of different commodities, well, you're getting hammered across the board today. So that diversification wouldn't have helped you very much.
Right. I mean, the key about diversification is non-correlation. If you want to diversify across assets, they have to be non-correlated. Otherwise, you're not diversifying at all. And if you're in a, you know, any kind of asset class is always going to be correlated. That's pretty simple. Equities or real estate or commodities, you know, it doesn't matter which area you're in, it's going to be correlated with all the other assets in that asset class. And really, historically, the asset class is the thing that makes the biggest difference. You know, it doesn't matter which 10 stocks you buy that much. You know, it's really more about what the index does if you're betting on the long side or on the downside. I mean, there are exceptions to that, but generally speaking, the asset classes tend to be highly correlated. So,
well, that leads me to another point, which is that I believe that in the last 20 years or so, and certainly in the last 5 years and 2 years, we have seen a higher correlation between asset classes than we've seen in a long, long time.
Absolutely.
And to be frank, I believe the investment environment is riskier today than it has ever been, because just the fact that things are so correlated means it's hard to find anywhere to hide. It's hard to find asset classes that are so completely unconnected to one another that you wouldn't expect one to rise or fall when the other one moves. And because of this, because you see that oil is correlated to the dollar, that all the commodities are correlated together, and then all of those are correlated to equities. You see equities crash when those are going down.
Yeah, they're so correlated, it's just ridiculous. Yeah, I don't even have to look at different markets anymore. I just watch what silver does, and then I know what happened to stocks and the dollar and interest rates, you know.
So the problem with the challenge, though, is that it leaves investors with nowhere to hide. You're basically having to put a stake in the ground saying, I'm going. It basically means diversification is just not possible.
Right. Yep. Well, I think the number one thing that most investors do is that they don't really have a game plan fully thought out. That's number one. That's the number one problem. And number two, they overestimate the amount of drawdowns they're willing to withstand. That's the other thing. This is why a lot of investors in 2008 sold right at the lows. Because let's talk about the first two rules. Well, rule number two is they thought, well, whatever happens, stocks go up in the long run. But they never really realized that they had a psychological limit of how far they would go before they would panic. Because they thought, well, I just won't panic, but people need to realize that you will panic. You know, there is a certain point you lose enough money, you're going to say, ah, get me out. Like, I can't do this. That's so. And then the rule I was talking about before about not having a game plan is really related. They're really closely related. You know, if you're going to buy an index fund, you better have a plan if the market does another 2008 and falls, you know, 60% or whatever, 50%. You know, what are you going to do when it's down 20? Or is that where you're going to sell or what? You know, because I guess what I'm just saying is you have to map out the fact that, well, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Here are potential scenarios, and here's how I would solve that problem. But people don't think that way. It's more, I guess it's kind of a gambling mentality in the sense they'll just buy an index fund and just cross their fingers. And then if things go down too much, they'll panic. And that's just seems to be what people end up doing. And I think it's really because a lot of it, I don't know. It's not a good way to do it. But
well, the very
it seems to be like a cultural thing almost, that that's the way you're supposed to do it.
The firm message I've been detecting that in of investment advice in general, and I think many people in the markets have are becoming inured to after the last decade and certainly the last several years, is the idea of patience and not panicking and sticking things out. Because a lot of people say, look, the people who didn't panic and sell, well, those are they did well because things recovered. And so the worst thing you could do is just sell and panic. So if there's we had a flash crash and the people who didn't panic did well. And so the worst thing you can do, I'm saying this is the kind of the wisdom
right,
that I'm
exactly.
hearing in the markets is the worst
exactly.
thing you can do whenever there's a crisis and a collapse in asset prices or a stock rout is to actually sell. Just stay tight. Take a Valium and don't worry about it.
Two sides to that. I know a guy who bought stocks in 2007. Put a lot of money in and rode the whole thing all the way down and basically said he couldn't sleep at all at night. But he never sold. And so, okay, this is one point, right, which is that, well, okay, he's almost back whole. He says he still doesn't feel good because he's still down. He still lost money since then. But, you know, he's glad he didn't sell at the bottom. But then there are many other times in history where, let's say if you had bought in 1928 or something and someone had told you, oh, don't sell, you know, because, you know, with the same wisdom that you're talking about, you know, you would have never gotten your money back, you know. So the main point is if you don't know what's going to happen, how can people give advice on that when they can't? You know, they have no crystal ball, you know, to say you should take infinite risk by putting all your money in stocks, for example, which to me that's infinite risk because you don't know what's going to happen with them or in any kind of correlated asset. You know, here's the simplest money management scheme I thought of recently. If you wanted to take risk and buy stocks, then at least if you put half your money in cash and then any time you made money, you put, you know, half of your earnings into that cash basket or whatever. We've talked about this before. I called it like the piggy bank approach. If you just did something like that where you at least put it away in something that's, you know, will probably maintain its value without too much fluctuation. I'm not saying cash is perfect. There have been horrible inflationary periods, but generally with interest – and even with taxes, cash has actually, in the United States at least, been relatively stable. And I know that's blasphemy, but you can go do the math and look at inflation numbers and you know, it's held relatively well, you know, with interest. But I want to clarify. I'm not saying the dollar has maintained its value. It hasn't. I'm saying with interest, you would have roughly maintained your purchasing power. If you had just done something like that, then when stocks crashed, you know, if you had bought in at a decent time, at least you'd have that cash that you made during the run-up. You know,
I think you could – maybe what a person could say is that sometimes it makes sense to panic.
Right, right. You know, here's the thing that Warren Buffett did, which was one of the reasons why he was so successful, which is that the average investor, what they do is they'll buy stocks near tops, and then they go to cash near bottoms. Of course, you can't – you don't know where tops and bottoms is. But generally what Warren Buffett's approach was to accumulate cash. So his whole point was when everything's going well, things are going up, he just accumulates a whole wad of cash, and then he only buys things that he thinks they're very reasonably, you know, priced. Of course, he also tries to buy whole companies. There's more to it. But
well,
the whole point was that investors underestimate how great cash can be in terms of reducing your risk, taking profits. You know, and then you can always go back in with that if you want. But, you know, I'm very much against the all-in mentality. I mean, I would never go to a slot machine and put all my money in it and then play it.
Well, but if you go back to your example of Mr. Buffett,
right.
One of his great achievements was timing, that he happened to be investing in one of the great bull markets.
Absolutely.
Of a century, and so that was a great time. And even his, you know, one of his great heroes, Mr. Grantham, is it not? Who Warren even says he learned a lot of the tricks of the trade with value investing from, that this gentleman was taken to the cleaners in the 1930s because it was the wrong time to be doing investing in equities. And
right.
It didn't matter how smart you were at investing, how good you were at analyzing companies and perceived value. If you're investing at the wrong time in a certain asset class, it's not going to turn out well, and it can't turn
right.
out well. That's an unfortunate truth there. And you know, we're talking about risk as well and when to know how to panic. And it just was occurring to me about this whole scenario with the tsunami in Japan, right?
Okay.
You can go for long periods of time with earthquakes and tsunamis that the people get comfortable with. Oh, it's, you know, in the last 100 years that we've never seen a tsunami bigger than this. And so then
right.
people will even say, "Hey, I'm going to go watch the water come in the bay,"
right?
Because they're looking for.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Just in general, people are unprepared for extreme or rare events, right?
And we become
acclimated to what just happened recently, and we're always prepared for what, you know, what just occurred. A perfect example is someone who has something very rare happen in their life. I don't know, they get struck by lightning and they survive it, and then from then on they don't want to go outside anymore. I don't know, something like that. But that's the way humans are kind of conditioned. You know, whatever happens recently, even if the odds are infinitesimal, if it does happen, you know, you're kind of prepared for that. And vice versa, if something never happens, you just think it's impossible. You know, it's like people right after the Great Depression were terrified of stocks, and, you know, it was the whole Tanstaffel thing was popular, where it was, you know, every dollar you had to earn, and risk-taking was nowhere to be seen. And then we go through decades where people just take on unbelievable, just preposterous amounts of risk with their wealth. Not ever even occurring to them that we could have another crash or any kind of event like that, just because it hasn't happened in so long.
Yeah, well, I, if there's anything I would say, it's that I think that it doesn't make sense to try to predict specific events, but if there's anything that we can say is true, is that the unbelievable or the inconceivable will happen.
That was the whole point of the black swan. He was saying these so-called inconceivable things are actually much more frequent
yep.
people think.
Like the tsunami, the 40-foot wave, the 40-foot high tsunami is really not as as improbable as people.
Here's the fascinating thing that you know, when you're talking about geological events like that, or anything that any kind of Earth-related events, weather or changes in climate, what's interesting, or volcanoes, that's a great example. What's interesting about volcanoes is that you'll tend to have small volcanoes, small eruptions very frequently, and then you'll tend to have these massive ones very infrequently. And then every million years, you get this, you know, just ridiculous one. They call them super volcanoes. I don't know. But the same thing applies to tidal waves and all kinds of other things in nature. And you look at the history of the stock market, and it's exactly the same thing. There are all these mini crashes, and they're pretty frequent, you know. And then every now and then, very rare, but you get a huge one. But they happen. So it's interesting. You know, it's actually very similar to the way these natural disasters happen. Sort of the same frequency and amplitude patterns you see in, you know, economic behavior.
Well, and just recently I was hearing, you know, they're having the flooding on the Mississippi River, and they blew the Army Corps of Engineers blew up a levee. On purpose to flood a region of farmland and some homes that were there as a floodway. And apparently that land for about a century has had easements on it, recognized that it was a potential floodplain. And so the Army Corps of Engineers reserved the right to use that as a release valve for the flooding. But if you have farmers and so on who've lived there for generations, in their time lifespan, and even across generations, no one remembers a flood. And to them, it's a disaster and almost inconceivable that something like this would happen now, that they decide to blow the levees and flood that land. So, but you know, something like that it was very predictable. I mean, you can't predict it on a year by year basis, but it's almost inevitable that it will happen.
Right. But, well, it's the difference between linear versus chaotic, I think. Like when humans are very well trained to deal with linear things, you know, oh, I burnt my finger touching that thing that was too hot. You know, I'm not going to touch it anymore, you know, versus, well, I've touched it, you know, 1,000 times and I didn't get burnt. And then the next day you burn your finger on it. I don't know. Like if something was more of a chaotic system, you know, we're just not wired to deal with that effectively. Tend to get acclimated and accustomed to, you know, what we experience regularly. Right.
But how do
make assumptions?
How should people deal with that? I don't even know. I mean, if something only happens like every 200-300 years and it's a terrible disaster when it happens, does that mean nobody should live there at all? Does that mean that nobody, because you'd think, well, you know, there's all this great farmland that's sitting there, why can't we use it? But when it does happen, it wipes the people out. The people who have investments there or whatever, they're just completely cleaned out.
Yeah, it's so sad.
And so I don't know. It leads you to wonder how. I don't even know what the right risk management strategy is, because you could say in one sense, well, it's, you know, it's a relatively good gamble. It's once in 100 years, but you know, it could be next year.
Right.
And so I don't know. I honestly don't know how to deal with something like that.
Get good insurance.
Well, the problem with that is, of course, that you can't get good insurance when there's easements on your property saying that it's the right for a spillway. There's consequences on that. So, you know, in fact, I think people knowing that kind of thing should be asking themselves whether they really should be doing significant
investment. I'll tell you one of the simplest rules of the stock market. Well, in fact, we already said it. The relationship between frequency and amplitude, that frequently you have these small mini rallies and crashes, and less frequently you have much larger ones. Okay? And even if that's all you knew, then you would know you could look at when the last major crisis was, and the one before that, and the one before that, and say, well, the large crises are probably going to be pretty far apart, and the smaller ones will be closer together and more frequent. Even if that was all you knew, then that would actually give you quite a leg up, in my opinion, about when it's safer to come out of the woodworks than when it's not.
Yeah. Well, in a way, you know, but when things are far apart, right? Like, again, talking about the flooding and when it only occurs.
I was just talking about the stock market, but I don't know. Okay, I see what you're saying. The longer separation between events, also the harder it is to pinpoint when it will happen.
Well, you don't know when it's going to happen. I mean, if you know something's going to happen every 5 years, okay, you can start to – then you say, I need to be prepared for this. This will happen. I have to have my assets hedged. I have to be protected in a way because I know that every 5 years or so, this is going to happen. But when something something can skip generations, right? Then it's really hard to know should you always be building in, like, should you always be over engineering your buildings and everything to survive this major thing that only happens once every 500 years. Because, I mean, it's a huge investment. You think that let's say it adds 30% of the cost to every building that's built to engineer it to be able to withstand a once in a 500 year incident. You could say, well, it's cheaper over time to never construct them to withstand that. But when that incident happens, it will be absolutely catastrophic, and everything will be wiped out if nothing had been created to withstand it. And the other thing is, when things are really long apart, the frequency, when they're extremely infrequent, you can very easily start to think, well, maybe things have changed. Maybe it won't happen. And it, certainly in the case of stocks, there's lots of rationales that people can come up to as to why these cycles might have changed. We have new technologies. Right. There's so many things that change in our societies that people can very easily – that you could – I mean, let's say that starting from today, there's no major stock market disruption or crash for the next 150 years. Well, absolutely, that will convince many, many people during that time frame that the government's gotten better at regulation, that society has changed, the markets are smarter, the new software and computer systems and artificial intelligence that they developed in 2060 is going to be so smart that it will prevent any kinds of major disasters from happening in equities, right? So it's all, if things are really far apart in frequency or they're highly infrequent, I think it's inevitable that people are going to come up with rationales to think that it won't ever happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's definitely a good point. This just sort of goes back to my whole thing about it being hard to predict the future. But we do have a record of the past, and we know what can occur. And so I don't know. I still stick back to what I said earlier about trying to reduce your exposure, reduce your risk is probably being the best thing the average person can do. But, you know, you'd get shot with an arrow in the back if you told someone that in 1980. You know, but that goes again with, you know, it's hard to know what's going to happen next. And with that given that the market's been rallying and things have been improving for a while now, do you think that the president will be reelected? Because I think it's a very real possibility given the performance of the stock market.
Well, what we're talking next year, right? 2012.
Correct. Maybe it's too early to postulate.
A lot can happen between now and then. If we really start going through some more severe deflation and crack-ups in the markets and recession part two, then, you know, I don't think the odds bode well for any politician in office anywhere in the world.
True. Yeah, I guess a lot can happen in 1 year. We'll see. When the flash crash happened a year ago. Can you believe it's been a year? It's been more than a year since the flash crash. You know, I thought that was it, and obviously that was not the case. So you just never know. This year could be full of surprises too. So we'll see We'll see what happens.
I firmly believe that I've always maintained that the politicians have relatively little control over what happens in the economy, one way or the other.
Right. But quite a bit of credit and blame.
Yes. And so if the economy does well under your while you are in office, you will do well at the polls as well. But if the economy does poorly, your tenure will be short-lived. So
right.
That's just the way it'll happen. And so in that sense, you know, it'll the success of the existing administration in the next election will be highly dependent on what happens in the economy and in the stock market, really.
Right, absolutely. You know, it's funny because when the news came out about Bin Laden, and I saw what happened to overnight markets. It was just this huge spike that corresponded with the news. Or it was actually early morning, sorry, in the E-mini futures. I don't know why I was staring at it, and I just was like, "That's a top," because it was just. I mean, I don't know why the market would rally like that, as if that had anything to do with improving the economic conditions. But that's kind of what happened, and immediately we started this downtrend that we've been in for the past few days. So,
well, we've talked about this before. We keep mentioning it again and again, but because it's so important, is that the misconception that the news drives what happens in stocks.
Right.
Or in any market, really.
Well, short term.
Very short term.
It was a huge change, yes. but it certainly was not a trend.
And I mean, you look at what's happened in Japanese stocks since their earthquake. Right. You know, they had a lot of volatility, but, you know, they've actually been going up. And you can't say that their economy is doing really well in particular. And even with the recent drop in commodity prices and the rise in the dollar, I find it just a hoot to read some of the articles trying to drum up explanations as to why they say, oh, it's because the European Central Bank president, Jean-Claude Trichet, was making comments about that sounded less hawkish regarding interest rates and things, and saying this is why the dollar is going up and the euro right. is going down. But yep. these are just journalists grasping for explanations for things that are inexplicable in anything other than just the vagaries of markets and the patterns of human behavior.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I mean that's the same way I feel. I can't stand reading market news anymore. It's just so much baloney, and it's just like armchair and making stuff up and blah blah blah. I mean, it's like anybody could do a financial. In fact, this is part of the reason we do it, because you can make up anything when you're looking at the markets and say, oh, that explains that. Oh, well, Motorola had good earnings today, so that. I don't know. I mean, you could just anything you could say. It's really nuts, I guess. You know, that's why you have people like Jim Cramer up there and people worshiping him. Because you can get away with just about anything.
So
as long as it seems logical.
So any things that you're going to be looking for in the next week?
I don't know. Dollars going to the moon. That's really the only thing I believe right now. It's just been so hated for so long. You know, it's not just the sentiment being like, you know, 5%, 5 to 7 around there, but it's the fact that it's been pinned there for like, I don't know how long it's been, half a year or so. You know, it is so overdue for a major correction here that I'm very bullish on the dollar, and so that's kind of why I feel that, you know, with this blow off exponential rise in silver and it's broken the parabolic curve, sorry, that it was tracking, it seems pretty clear to me that that we're going down for a while here. And it's this is right after I talked about how no one should speculate, no one should predict the future. I don't know. But this just seems pretty obvious to my opinion. Obvious in my opinion, which is very fallible.
Well, I've noticed a couple things that I've seen recently is there's been a lot of talk about purchasing and actually there's a bidding war for the New York Stock Exchange, and I recall that stock exchange mergers and buyouts and so on have often happened at market tops. In the past, so take that for what you will. And another interesting thing is that I've seen some more prominent diehard deflationists move into the inflationist camp recently.
Right. Oh yeah, I could see that. I mean, it's just because the dollar went so far, but and it did break the low that it had made. What was it, 2009, I think, and I think that's when a lot of people freaked out. But it never broke the 2007 low, and that's the linchpin, in my opinion. Like I said, if it broke that low, then I would probably switch to the inflation camp pretty quickly. But if that low holds and we start rallying from here, I'm sticking with deflation as that's how it's going to go down.
You know, the irony is when the housing bubble was going on, I mean, I was concerned there was a housing bubble, you know, even back in 2002.
Yeah.
And back then I remember, well, and throughout the whole bubble, as it would get bigger and bigger, people would tell me, well, now are you convinced that the bubble is – that there's no bubble because it was going way longer than I ever thought there could be? And I was telling them, I would say – no, I'm actually now more worried than I was before because it's getting even – it's even frothier and bigger. But the longer it would go, higher the bubble would get, or the bigger the bubble, there'd be these people telling me, well, now aren't you now convinced that there's not a bubble? And the irony is the lower the dollar goes – I mean this is going to sound really cracked, I guess, but the lower the dollar goes, the higher gold and silver go, and the fewer people who are bearish on precious metals and or bullish on the dollar, the more convinced I am that you're absolutely right.
From a contrarian perspective, those are the conditions that accompany every high and every low in every market. It's always when it's gone on for a while and everyone's piled on one side of the trade, and that's when the trend changes, and it could change for a decade. You know, so and the more extreme usually these sentiments are, and the longer and harder these bubbles have been formed, you know, the longer and larger the trend change generally is. So, I mean, that to me, that's just an obvious – it's like a law of the markets. That's the way they've always operated and always will operate. So you're absolutely right. I mean, but picking the top of the bubble, forget it. But recognizing a bubble, I think a reasonably smart person, you know, should be able to do that and see just how crazy things are. Think, well, they could get a lot crazier before this thing tops, but – regardless, it's a bubble, and bubbles are extremely destructive to the majority of people that participate in them, just in the same way pyramid schemes are. You know, a few people do make a lot of money from bubbles, but the vast majority of people will, in the end, after everything is said and done, lose quite a bit of money.
And on that upbeat note, it's been great having you on the show, Elliot, and another great conversation.
Oh, I got to tell you, I know I always throw in a quick Bitcoin blurb.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
But and speaking of bubbles, Bitcoin just went to $3.40 per coin. And this is, you know, when we first started tracking them, they were 6 cents each. I don't even know what kind of return that is. Was it 60 times or 70 times?
So and since we were tracking it, they had a crash at one point, right?
Yeah, they actually fell 80% at one point. And to be honest, I'm currently bearish on Bitcoins because I think they went up. They actually went up to like $4 at the peak, but they peaked right with silver. They follow silver. It's like you said, it's all the same market. They're again, you know, move opposite the dollar. So now that we've seen a change here, we're probably going to see Bitcoins fall quite a bit. But I don't believe they're going to be like other commodities that fall a lot. I think it'll go into a decline, but I'm still bullish on them in the long term just because it's very unique, because it has such a tiny user base. And as the user base grows, you know, the marketplace grows, it will it should appreciate because of that. So it's kind of a unique case. But
we'll have to keep following it, and you can update us in our next show.
Yeah, we got to start doing these each week, just like we used
to. Get back on the horse.
Exactly.
Hey, good night, Elliot.
All right. See you, Michael.
For more episodes of Bear Radio, go to www.surkan.com. That's www.surkan.com.